I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. An old pal of mine that I never met, Luke Skyscraper James, who was the lead guitarist and a singer with a band called Fashion, amongst other things. And today we're going to be talking about what it was like to work your ass off and not really come out with a pocket full of money, and other things related to the live business. So how are you doing, Luke?
I'm doing all right, thanks, Frank. It's a nice sunny day, a bit chilly here in Northern California, where I've been for the last 32 years. So I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Fabulous. I'm in Flagstaff, Arizona, looking at the forest. Not a cloud in the sky, but it's a balmy 32 degrees today. But quite lovely. And I also had 30 years in San Francisco. So
all right.
It's
good.
It doesn't matter where you are.
Doesn't know. I'm an old guy in a back room with a room full of guitars and a little recording studio. And I'm I like to say I started out 50 years ago. I was unemployed and in one band, and 50 years later, I'm unemployed and in three online bands, and that's what I call progress. Yeah. I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah, I actually nearly saw Fashion once. I was in London. And at that time I had been living in New York for a while, and I was in London doing something with a Simple Minds, and they said, there's this band called Fashion, they're playing tonight at some club just off of Oxford Street. I think it was called the Zebra or one of those pop-up clubs, and
right.
Anyway, I didn't wait around for you to come on. It took too long, and my date said, let's go back to the hotel. So I did. So look, you sound like you're from the Midlands somewhere.
Yeah, I'm from Birmingham. Yeah, I mean, I've maybe got a vestige of the accent, but
you've still got it.
My dad tried to beat it out of me with a stick. You know, my dad was a taxi driver. And he say, "You're not going to talk like I am. You're going to learn how to talk proper." and then having sort of lived in different places, I lived in France for a while, and I've lived here for 32 years, so I don't know what my accent is.
I'm still Scottish, apparently.
Yeah, I admire you. I admire you, and other Scots that I know, that you manage to keep that. It's really cool.
I know.
I don't know how you do it.
Well, I know guys from my village who would go to Blackpool for the weekend and come back saying, "You're all right, love." So let's. Did you grow up in a musical family?
Oh, not at all. No. In fact, I saw Jimi Hendrix on the Lulu Show on a little black and white telly when I was 14, and my dad made some comments and about the noise, and I just immediately thought, I want to do that. I want to look at him. He's crazy. I want to do that. Far from being musical, my dad, when I first started learning to play guitar when I was 15, 16, apart from the fact that even though he was quite tall, I got derided as being the freak because I was a foot taller than everybody else at any age you care to name, pretty much, but he'd bring his taxi driver friends would come around sometimes and he'd say, "Go get that guitar out and give us all a laugh." And I'd drag the guitar out and try to play something and sing it, and they'd all laugh at it. What a load of rubbish. God, look, listen to that, honestly. And then one time I managed to play something in tune and in time. I think it was a Hollies song or something. I can't remember now. And I felt dead proud. I was like, yep, there, take that, And he just sort of sniffed and said, "Well, it's not that good." So no encouragement, no musical background. It came out of rebellion more than anything.
And before you saw the Hendrix thing, what are your early recollections of sound, and specifically sound as it relates to music?
I was really into pop music from when I was 11. when the Beatles, you know, remember the Beatles coming on the radio and every new song was magic. And I was really, my first, I saved up my pocket money and the first record I bought was All Day and All of the Night by the Kinks. And I had a little Dansette record player, you know, with one speaker in it. And I was always being told to turn it down. It's the story of my life with sound, just being told to turn it down. Well, still is.
You are a guitar player, yeah, you know.
Yeah, really, honestly. But go ahead.
As a sound man, I'm still doing it. With guitar players.
No, absolutely. Well, when we first formed Fashion, I mean, we all knew each other from the Dole in an area of Birmingham called Moseley, which is one of the kind of slightly bohemian areas, I suppose, of, you know, you'd see all the English Beat and all the Beat, as we called them then, and UB40, and who took their name from the, you know, the Dole card, and bits of Duran Duran and Fashion. We'd all be in the Dole queue, you know, all wearing makeup, dyed hair and clothes and stuff. And they'd always ask you, they'd say, you know, this one girl who was the Dole clerk, you know, they used to actually give you a gyro in those days, give you a check. And they always asked you if you'd done any work since you last signed on. And so I remember one time the girl asking me, have you done any work since you last signed on? And I said, no. And she said, saw your band at the Barrel Organ last night. Oh, shit. I was about to say we didn't get paid, and she just looked at me and said, you are crap, and handed me my gyro. So that's how we started. But one of the first things that occurred to me was my best friend was a kid from school called Mickey Cottrell, and he'd always been like interested in sound, like old reel-to-reel tape recorders and stuff. And he'd recorded some of my acoustic stuff over the years. And so when we were practicing, I remember we were practicing in a pub in Birmingham, the Old Crown. And I remember going in one night, so we need somebody to do the sound. And I'm like, why? I'm like, well, because we want to sound good, right? Well, do you know anybody? I said, I know just the chap. So, you know, we had a 50-watt Selmer amp and a 4x12 cab that we use as a PA and three microphones. And so Mickey came down and moved a couple of microphones around, listened for a bit, told me to turn down. And that was it. None of us really knew what we were doing. We'd never been in a recording studio before.
Yeah.
And, so pretty early on I understood how important it was going to be to have us sound the way we thought we were sounding when other people listened, you know, and he sorted us out.
Well, you got the right end of the stick very early on because not a, well, I suppose a matter of economics and also the sound systems back then, well, they weren't that sophisticated.
That's right.
With what you had. I remember Selmer amps, though, and little columns and stuff, you know, little 4x12 boxes or 4x10, some of them. And
when you started, let me ask you this, when you first started, did you find that, like right at the very beginning, Frank, were you doing more than just the sound? Did you find that occasionally you were doing the driving or?
I was a roadie. I was lugging gear. I didn't drive in those days. I was in those days I was designated drunk, so I didn't do any. I didn't do any driving. Thank God, so there'd have been carnage. I started. Just humping. I'll tell you how I got into it. I was walking down the street in 1966 in London, at Carnaby Street, the year England won the World Cup. And I was shouting for Germany, but we won't go there. Anybody but England. And so I saw this van with Scottish plates on it, and not even Scottish plates, but from my county, from Stirlingshire. And I got talking to the guys, and it was a band that were down in London for the weekend buying clothes, and they said, if you come up the road, come and see us. And so I went back to Scotland, as we all do, come and go, and from London. And I went to see them and ended up jumping in the van with them and helping them out with the gear the next weekend. And I never got out. So I
never got out the van?
No, I got in a van in 66 and I'm still getting in vans.
Yeah, you go. Sometimes it's hard to get out of that van, Frank. It's impossible.
You know, they're a bit more luxurious than they used to be these days. Yeah. And the odd private jet as well. But then I started with a four-channel Vertexi, and it was a valve amp, and it was a fairground amp. It was actually military grade for parade grounds is what it was.
Wow.
For the 79-volt systems that they had in the fairgrounds. But I'm going to buy one and use it for my stereo at some point.
There you go. That's a great idea,
I've looked them up, and they still make them. It was a metal case with two handles on it, like an ammo box. And it was the fairground boys had to get it loud to get it over the noise of the rides back then. And the bingo callers, you know, the microphone with a hanky over it.
It
sounded like it was coming through, you know, 3 foot of cotton wool.
I remember we got our first tour was opening for John Cooper Clarke. So we had to supply the lighting rig and help carry the PA, and we got £50 a night. And Cooper Clarke is a brilliant bloke. He turned up with his manager in a mini with two carrier bags, you know, one with a bottle of vodka in it and the other one full of poetry. he was the nicest bloke I think I ever met on the road, to be honest. Mickey had the idea. He said, well, these PAs that we're using are not going to be very good because this bloke's, you know, it's one bloke with one spotlight and one microphone. So the chances are, I think the first gig was in a room over a furniture shop in Plymouth or something like that. And so he had the idea. He said, on the way, let's stop at a music shop and he rented a Watkins copycat, you know, one of those tape loop things. So he put whatever PA we had went through, you know, he plugged that in and every at like crucial junctions, because we used to play a little, we used to mix up reggae, techno and punk all within the same song. So when we went into like a reggae break, he'd hit the Watkins copycat. It'd be like Bob Dread going around the room, and then we'd go back to, you know, some punk. But it was his idea and it was a great idea, you know.
We had to be inventive back then. We didn't have the technology or the money.
Really? Yeah, that's right. That's right. We did have one incident when we took it back, when we took the Watkins copycat back. We got to this, we'd finished the tour and on the way back to Birmingham, excuse me, and we went to the music store and we took the Watkins copycat back, got our deposit, whatever. And there was a kid there and he was talking to us, oh, you're in a band and all this stuff, you know. And I, we're in a band. We've just finished a tour. And he's like, oh, do you guys need some guitar strings? And I'm like, no, I think we're all right, you know. And he says, no, they're free. I'm going to throw them out. They're okay. We're just going to throw them out. So he's giving me guitar strings. I'm like, yeah, all right, mate. Thanks a lot, you know. But unbeknownst to me, he's done the same to Mulligan, our bass player, and to Dick, our drummer. So we've all got these loads of strings. We get back to the van in the car park. And stuff them all into the glove compartment. We're all laughing about the fact that this kid gave us all these strings for free. And as we're about to pull out the car park, these two cars pull in front of us and block us. And these blokes jump out, flashing badges, like, you know, plain clothes. And Mickey winds the window down, and the cop says, a vehicle matching this description was used in a bank robbery yesterday here in Cheltenham. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, that's right. We robbed the bank yesterday, but we're just now making our getaway. And he looked at me and he said, you, what's your name? Out the van. So I got locked up. Yeah, I got locked up taking this thing back. So I spent several hours in a lockup in Cheltenham. Just at one point, the little thing in the door opened. And there's this copper's face, and I'm thinking, oh, man, he's not going to come in here and start beating me up or something, you know. And he looks at me and he goes, do you like a cup of tea? I got that Cheltenham accent. And I said, yeah, all right. And he said, you can have a chicken salad as well if you like. I said, all right. So it wasn't exactly police brutality, you know. When I finally let me out, all the others were waiting. They were all complaining about having to sit on a hard wooden bench for 5 hours. I said, I was just in a cell with no handle on the inside of the door, getting threatened with a chicken salad, and you've got the nerve to complain about having to wait for me. So anyway, all worked out in the end. So, you know, a little spin-off adventures from the inventiveness of our sound man, Mickey Cottrell.
I'm looking at a tiny bit of research I did on you. The plastic wasp synthesizer. I actually bought a wasp synthesizer for my then girlfriend. I was at the Manor, Branson Studio, working on it was either on the New Gold Dream record with Simple Minds or on an album, but a little French language album I made with a young punk band from Paris back then as well. And the manager of the studio's husband had he was a musician. He had one of these wasp things to sell. And I at the time, I had a girlfriend who played keyboards in New York in a band. And I went, oh, okay. I can't remember how much I paid for it. I think I got done. I think I paid 75 quid for it. It was the most obtuse, awful little thing to get a sound, to get a sound out of. It was monophonic. You couldn't do anything with it.
Right. Absolutely, and it was a touch sensitive keyboard.
Yes,
and if you were in some club that had got a bit of a dodgy power supply, it'd just go off on its own.
Yeah,
you know, Mulligan would be playing bass, and he used to switch between bass and the wasp, and sometimes it'd just go off. It's nowhere near it, you know. There was another thing about how Mickey was really important. Was one of the things about Mulligan was that, how can I put this politely? Oh, I can't. He never learned to play. I mean, he played bass, but he never learned the names of the notes or any scales. So I would come up with the bass lines, or he'd try to copy a reggae bass line or something, and he'd memorize the patterns. So a lot of the time, in the early days especially, he was all over the place. So what Mickey would do, doing sound, would be, he'd suss that John was having a rough night on bass, that Mulligan was having a rough night. So he'd actually just take the bass out of the mix, mix up the kick drum, and mix up the floor tom. And I've got quite a deep voice. And put some bottom on the end of my... So very often we were playing parts of shows. It was just me and the drummer and vocals. And Mulligan's playing away on stage, but nobody's hearing it unless you're right at the front, you know. And I think that helped... He recognized we needed a bit of sound man surgery to get the best possible sound. And then as John got better, you know, he'd add more and more bass in until by the time we were actually, you know, playing tours, John was playing most of the time, you know. But, those wasps, they've just come out, Behringer have just come out with a wasp module. And I just actually got one there's a bloke I'm working with. One of my three online bands is the Pool of Autumn, a guy called Daniel Darrow out in Rhode Island. He saw me play with Fashion at the Rat Club in Boston.
Oh, boy.
And him and his wife become big fans of the band. And now, 40 years later, I'm in a band with him. And he had a band called Joanna's House of Glamour that was signed to Rough Trade. But anyway, I just got him one of those wasp modules because... Yeah, I
wonder whatever happened to that. I wonder if she's still got it. I shall have to ask her. I see too that you got picked up by a manager. At what point in the proceedings was that?
Yeah.
Early on?
Yeah. Well, early on we had a manager, a lady called Annette. And she became our manager in the very early days because she was the only person we knew with a phone. So Mulligan started handing her phone number out to people trying to get us gigs. But he didn't tell her. So she was our manager, but she didn't know until the phone started ringing. Because we'd created, through a poster campaign and a little bit of word of mouth, we created quite a buzz about us in Birmingham. Our early gigs were a lot of people showing up at pubs and... So she was getting these phone calls. So he said, yeah, well, you've got a phone, so you'll be our manager, right? So she agreed. And she did an amazing job for a couple of years. She kept us alive and kept the whole thing together. But she was the one who kind of directed us to this little muse area, off Blenheim Crescent. We went to see this bloke called Miles Copeland, who was the manager of an unknown band called The Police. and he listened to our first single, which we made ourselves, 1,000 copies, Steady Eddie Steady, it was called. And he listened to it, and it was really, he's a really weird bloke.
I know.
Oh, you know him. You've spoken to him. I've met him recently.
I've met him once or twice.
So when we went into his office, he didn't really know, excuse me, we didn't have an appointment. He didn't really know who we were. We went in. So there's this bloke, and he's got this chair that's got like golden lions for arms. So it looks like a throne, and it's on a slight, like on a little drum riser at the end of the room. And he looks like John Denver a little bit, right? He's got this really loud voice. You know, so he listens to it and he goes, yeah, I like this. This is good. Okay. Here's what I'm going to do for you. And so he agreed to get another 5,000 copies pressed and get us some gigs in London, which he did. And the first one was with the Police at King's College, 1978, I suppose. Yeah. Before they'd had their hit record, you know. But we became kind of one of his stable of support bands. He had a bunch of them. There was the Cramps, and occasionally, like when the Police took off, Squeeze went to A&M. We toured with Squeeze as well. But we were kind of the go-to opening act, always having the carrot dangled in front of our nose that, you know, you're going to be next. And it was weird because it was like indentured labor, you know. We had barely enough money to stay alive. One time I was at Kane's Ballroom in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and we'd done a sound check, and we were opening for the Police, and I'm sitting at a table, and I overhear Miles saying to Sting's complaining because Message in a Bottle isn't in the charts in America. Excuse me. And I overhear Miles say, well, we'll just have to spend another $250,000 on promo. And I'm sitting there with like $58 in my pocket in the world, basically, you know, and my record's not on the radio. There's no promo going on there for Fashion. And that was kind of the deal, you know, that. But on the other hand, I had never been on an airplane before. And Miles Copeland put me on an airplane. And he not only put me on an airplane, he took us to New York. And the first night we were there, we opened for Patti Smith at CBGB's. So the adventures I had because of that man, you know, all in my book, Stairway to Nowhere, available from lulu.com. Oh, sorry, Frank.
I shall have to get a copy. So was your agent Copeland's brother? In New York?
Yes, Ian Copeland.
Ian was an old buddy of mine, a very good friend of mine.
He was a smashing bloke. Vietnam vet.
Oh, yeah. I know Ian very, very well. I took Simple Minds to him. I dropped him in his lap. I said, Bruce, this is Bruce Finlay. He manages Simple Minds. This is Ian Copeland. Bruce needs an agent. That's how the conversation went. Unannounced, I walked into his office.
Wow, good for you, man. That's great. Wow.
I didn't get a cup of tea out of it, but there you go. I mean, I said, you know, you get me a lobster dinner or something, you know. But no, in those days, and I'm still, you do people favors. If you do a good turn, you're doing a good turn, you know.
But
it's funny because I talked to Stuart Copeland I was at the very last show that Curved Air played in London, and he was a drummer, and he was also, I think, the partner of the lead singer, Sonia Christina, or whatever.
Right, he was, yeah.
And I was talking to him after it, and I said, so what are you going to do now with this band breaking up? He said, oh, I'm starting this punk rock group called The Police. I remember him saying that to me, and I went, oh, well, that's a good idea. And there you have it. Yeah. There you have it.
Wow. So right at the very beginning, yeah.
But you know, there's one thing about name dropping, and Mick Jagger told me this. I did a corporate thing with Sting a couple of years back in New York, and he's a diamond geezer. He was a lovely guy. He knows why he's there. He knows he's there to sign and pose and smile for the camera.
Right, right.
But his band were great and the songs were great, you know. So good luck to him.
Yeah.
He worked long and hard for it. But I've been to Cairns Ballroom in Tulsa. It's no place to be poor.
There's all these gigantic posters of like Hank Williams and Loretta Lynn and all those sort of big sepia portraits and you know we're in the middle of cowboy country here and we're all wearing makeup and you know we had the typical kind of easy rider type scene in a diner in Mississippi where we went in. It was in the middle of nowhere. And I went up to the counter. They all sat down. I went up to the counter to get, you know, order the food. And the waitress just ignored me. And there's two blokes sitting at the end of the counter. And one of them says, I can't use the language he used on the podcast. But, you know, S word, what the bleep is that? And the other guy says, I don't know, but I wish I had my gun. And he's talking about me, right? I'm standing there, excuse me, can I have 5 cheeseburgers and 5 Cokes and some fries, please? And the other guy says, well, I got mine out in a pickup truck. And I thought, oh, no, we're in the middle of nowhere. They could kill us and bury the truck and nobody'd ever find us for 2,000 years. So we left hungry and just kind of drove off.
Oh, yeah, I've had some experiences like that. I went to Cairns Ballroom more than once with Talking Heads.
Oh, okay.
We played there a few times. It was first time nobody was there. The second time we did okay, and I think the third time we went back, we sold it out. Not. It's not easy to sell out in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with anything.
Yeah. I was thinking about this last night. I was thinking, one of the things when you go on stage, you're vulnerable. Right, you can't put yourself up there. You're in front of a bunch of people who can and in the past have and will throw the furniture at you or cans or bottles or ice cubes or anything they can get their hands on if they don't. So you're kind of vulnerable. So your trust in the guy who's controlling how you sound has to be, you have to trust the guy, you know. And that trust should never be betrayed. And there was one thing that happened, and to this day, I'm ashamed of this. This is kind of confessional now. This is difficult for me to admit. But we were playing Riverside College near Los Angeles in this gigantic, I don't know whether it was a gymnasium or a hall, they got something huge. And there was a hair band that went on first from LA, and I can't remember who they were. Although the guitar player ended up being Sting's guitar player on solo projects years later. And then there was us, and then there was the Police, and the place was packed. And I don't know, maybe 3,000 people or something. And for some reason, I was out of the dressing room, and the other guys, Dick and Mulligan, and Annette, the manager, they decided that they didn't want Mickey to do the sound that night. They wanted what's his name? Rob Turner. Kim Turner, the Police's sound guy, to do sound for us. So Mickey, having driven us, he's the only one with a driver's license, he's driven us across the states and back up and down, helped to carry the gear, you know, done the sound, suddenly gets told, you're not doing the sound tonight. So I come into the dressing room and he's storming past me. And on his way out, and they tell me, yeah, we're going to have Kim do the sound tonight. And I'm like, what? No, Mickey's our sound guy. No, we want to try Kim. And this is to my shame, I didn't stand up for him. I should have said, you know what? If he's not doing the sound, I'm not going on. So you can forget about us playing. But I didn't. I caved. And we went on. And of course, Kim is a great bloke, great sound man for the Police. He doesn't know our set. He doesn't know it at all, you know. So after the second number, I suddenly feel something ping me in the side of the head. I went, what was that? And then there's a lot of it coming, and it's ice. They're throwing ice cubes at us. They're coming through the lights, and you can't see them. And it's like a little piece of glass, you know. So we're getting pelted at the end of the song. The people are booing. Get off, boo! Yeah, you guys suck. And I'm like, oh, this is good. I remember saying, well, I'm glad you are. I'm sorry you're not having a good time. I am, actually. And then going to the next number. And we basically got, you know, bottled off after about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you know. And that came from betraying the trust in the man who made you sound good. And it was wrong. It was shameful. Shouldn't have done it. But afterwards, basically, you know, we apologized to him. And he said, "You ever pull any, you know what, like that again, and I'm gone. And good luck." You know. And he did, actually. When we came back from the second tour of the States, he decided he had enough, and he went off, and he ended up as a road manager and also sound mixer for, well, he worked with Ry Cooder and Phil Collins. He did all right for himself because he was good at what he did, you know. By then he'd learned.
Yeah.
But you betray that trust at your peril, you know, and that was a harsh lesson. And once he was gone, I was only with the band for about another 6 months. And guys tried to do our sound, and, you know, some of them were good. But there was no relationship there, Frank, is the thing. I think the relationship between the band and the sound guy is really crucial, you know.
David Byrne said to me, I said to him, "What are you looking for?" When I first got involved, I said, "What are you looking for from me?" And he said, "Don't get bored out there."
Great.
Great advice. The smartest things anyone's ever, because I'm going to do what I like anyway. I'm going to do it like I see it, or do it like I hear it. But I was just giving him the courtesy of you know, thinking he was involved when he wasn't. I want your involvement. You sing the songs and I'll mix them, okay? That's the involvement.
There you go. You know, there you go.
You're singing it up, Mike. Give me. But
But
the other thing is too, was Mickey hands on and instrumental in shaping the sonic quality that was coming off the stage?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I only used one effect on my guitar, other than a bit of reverb, which he tended to control through the PA, and any echo he controlled through the PA. And I used an Electric Mistress flanger. Was the only on stage effect I ever had the whole time, and so he did. He totally shaped how it moved, how it sounded, but also how it moved. He loved to, and when he produced the first album, Product Perfect. Again, we're in a 16-track studio, Grosvenor Studios in Handsworth in Birmingham. The guy there has only ever recorded classical music, a couple of brass bands, and some reggae bands. He's never recorded, you know, anything like us. And so he was a really nice bloke, good engineer. So we had to kind of try to figure out how to do the production ourselves. You know, Miles Copeland gave us 2 weeks to record an album. He said, "Well, the Police recorded Outlandish Demore in 2 weeks. You guys have got 2 weeks." Well, okay, thanks. But Mickey had to figure it out as he went along. On the album where it says produced by Mickey Cottrell and Fashion, the only production by Fashion was, "Well, can I be a bit louder?" And Mickey saying, "No, shut up." Basically, it was produced by him. You know, he had to deflect our egotistical demands to be louder in the mix, to keep everybody happy and make it sound good. And he saw that as an extension of what he'd been doing, you know, for us in live shows. And he knew how to move stuff from speaker to speaker so that it really worked great.
This whole pandemic thing has made, you know, it's made a huge dent. And I'm so glad I got to do what it, because at the moment I'm still traveling with the B-52s. I'm their production manager and sound guy. And everything went away, you know.
That's right. A lot of my friends are like stage managers or sound mixers, you know, guys that I've known back through the years. And you suddenly go from being the stage manager and you're on Iron Maiden's private jet to you're back in Wolverhampton and, you know, you've got no work. For all of those guys. I know. Actually, the B-52s, that's where you and I intersect, because that was the first B-52s UK tour. We were the support band on that. Fashion was the support band.
Oh, yeah. What year was that?
That was 79.
We took them around Europe, I think, in 78 with Talking Heads. They opened for us. They were our baby band in the office. And I used to put them on.
They were really great. They were lovely people. They really were. We had a great time.
They still are.
Good. No. Good. That's great to hear. It was a weird tour, Frank. It started at the Lyceum in London, the first show. And we went on and it went really well. And then when the reviews came out, the deal was in those days that you get one newspaper that liked you and one that didn't. And NME hated us because they were all into Joy Division or whatever, you know. We actually had a kind of a fist fight altercation with at the Manchester Free Trade Hall once. We won't go into too many details about that. We won. The review from NME said that we were absolutely the biggest load of rubbish that anybody had ever heard, and that the B-52s were brilliant. And the review in Sound said the opposite, that the B-52s weren't very inspiring and that fashion were the next new thing and were amazing. And I cut those out and carried them around with me for years to try and not start believing, you know, my own publicity or my own version of, it's like, well, remember this, you know, it's just somebody's opinion. And don't get caught up in how great you are, because it's not necessarily so, you know. So it was strange. We played Eric's in Liverpool, and the tunnel under the Mersey closed at 11 o'clock. So the support band went on second. So the B-52s went on when the club was full. Everybody had an amazing time. And then everybody left to get the bus under the tunnel or to drive under the tunnel to go home. And we went on at 11 o'clock after the tunnel had shut. The only people there were the B-52s. And so they got down the front and they were dancing to us. And I'm like, oh, my God, this amazing band. And they're like dancing to us. That was one of the best shows for me. You know, it didn't matter to me there wasn't anybody there other than them. It was awesome.
I remember Eric's very well. I can still smell it.
Yes, it did stink.
Oh, my.
They had fried food in there as well as the usual smells.
The condensation when it got full and everything else.
Oh, God.
I can't believe Talking Heads and the Ramones played there.
That's amazing.
On the same night.
Wow.
That's mental.
Wow. I did get to play with the Ramones once. It was the Police, the Ramones, and Fashion. And it was at somewhere in Ohio, Bansfield, I think it was called. And I didn't know that the Ramones were on the bill. And we got there for the sound check. And I went into the hall and I looked up on the stage and there was their drum kit. And I'm like, what? And Annette, our manager, said, oh, yeah, I was keeping it as a surprise. I'm like, what? But this is like, these guys are my idols. I mean, the 1977, I spent the whole summer just listening to their album. I wore it out, you know. Oh, my God, we're on the bill with them. And they were really nice as well, you know. They were good blokes.
Yeah, I have big history with them.
Yeah, you did. They were incredible.
A lot of history. So these days, you're This well, we're talking during the pandemic. There's no live music. It's just awful. And
it is.
And what are young bands? Where are they going to learn? I'm hoping that they're sitting in basements and they've got their garage band out or Logic and they're knocking something out.
Yeah. But, I know they are through social media. I'm in touch with a few people, and there's a band in I think they're in Wisconsin somewhere that I know through my bandmate Eric Anderson in The Ghost of Luke James, and they're a band called Wasted Pretty. That's what they're called, and they're a brother and sister who are like 18 years old and a drummer, and they're like a basic punk band, but they're cranking it out, you know, and they're not alone, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at Billie Eilish, and she started out writing songs and recording them in her bedroom with her brother, and you know she's a huge star now. So I think they're out there. I think Fender's sold more guitars this year than they ever have in their history in a 1 year period.
Wow!
And
that's a good statistic. So it gives me a little hope.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm going to sail off into the sunset.
All right, mate.
But thanks
Lovely
very much.
To you,
Lovely talking
oh,
to you.
You.
Take
You're
it easy.
You're welcome, mate. You too.
Ta-ra.
Ta-ra. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in. And don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. I have an amazing lineup of guests coming up. And hold on, before you go, I have a bit of extra for you. This is a track from This Twisted Wreckage, featuring today's guest, Luke Skyscraper James on vocals, and Ricky Humphrey doing the music. Brave New World. Enjoy. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black and Chet Bentley, web design by Adelaide Bell, original music by Paul Westwater, and publicity by Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.